justice delayed is justice denied. The families of three Aboriginal children murdered nearly 30 years ago are still waiting for justice. There's a 16-year-old girl, a 16-year-old boy, and a 4-year-old girl that were all killed within 5 months of each other in a small rural town in New South Wales called Bowraville. And the families believe that this toxic combination of racism and incompetence and double standards conspired to keep the main suspects in the crimes, a white man who can't be named, out of prison. Dan Box is a former crime reporter for The Australian who did a podcast about the murders and has now released a book about the case and the painful quest the families still face to be seen and heard. The book is called Bowraville, and Dan Box joins us now. Hi there, Dan.
Hi, good to be here.
Thanks for your time today. Two police investigations, multiple trials, a parliamentary inquiry, and appeals to the High Court. It's a really complicated story. And so setting aside the legal wrangling, can you give us a bit of an outline of what happened between September 1990 and February 1991 in Bowraville in New South Wales?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, at its heart, this is a case about three murders. It's a serial killing, and the serial killer involved is still out there today. No successful attempt has been mounted to put whoever killed those children behind bars. So what happened, this goes back to 1990, 1991, just 5 months over the summer of those 2 years. And three children, all of them living in the same town, all of them living on the same street, disappear at parties. And the same white man is seen at each of those parties. And at the time, the police, it's almost as if they don't respond. The three families report their children missing, and the police, they say, well, maybe your kids have gone walkabout. And even after the second one disappears, they don't treat them as murders. They treat them as missing persons, and they say they can't be connected. And then even after the third one disappears, they still don't treat them as connected crimes. And then they find the bodies. And I've spoken to the detective, the forensic detective, who was called to the scene of the discovery of that first body. And he described this creeping fear that it was the fear he'd been pushing to the back of his mind all these months, that maybe this meant there was a serial killer on the loose. And despite that, we're still here a generation later, and that crime has not been resolved.
And the context for this is what you call the legacy of racism in the town. And so, for example, and this is only 1990, at the time of Colleen's murder, Aboriginals weren't allowed to drink at the bar in the local hotel, only out the back. How did Colleen's mum describe growing up in Bowraville as an Aboriginal?
Look, part of it, she said, it was a wonderful place to grow up, because obviously it was her country. You know, this is where her family are from. This is where she grew up. It's a beautiful country. It's rolling green, subtropical hills, this amazing stretch of coast with crystal clear water, white beaches. And the town itself is pretty, wooden buildings, pastel colours. But if you were an Aboriginal kid growing up in that town, you weren't allowed into those shops on the high street. In the cinema, they had separate doors for the white folk and the Aboriginal population. They had to sit in separate chairs, roped off from each other. And there was a lot of hostility and a lot of misunderstanding. And the sad thing is, I think the effect of these murders. So when I first went to Bowraville, which was 25 years after the murders happened, because there hadn't been justice or there hadn't been anyone convicted of these crimes, it felt as if the town couldn't move forwards. It felt as if the town's white population, the town's black population, was still deeply resentful of each other. As one person said to me, in fact, Muriel Craig, who's Colleen's mum, she said to me, there's a lot of hate in Bowraville today.
What was the first hint that these cases weren't being treated the same way as they might have been if it was wealthy kids or, you know, kids in some sort of darling Sydney suburb who'd gone through the same thing? What are some of the missteps in the investigation?
Look, I think the fundamental misstep, if you talk to the individual police officers involved, they're good, decent people. they want to see killers put behind bars. No one wants a killer out walking the streets. But the fundamental difference, if this was three white kids who'd gone missing on the North Shore of Sydney, you can imagine that area being flooded with police officers. You can imagine 100 detectives being put on the task force. In Bowraville, there were three detectives working part-time. They had no computers. They were using a manual typewriter out of the back of one of their cars to take statements. And they kept asking their bosses for help. And they kept being told, nah, you're fine, you've got this. So the decisions were being made high up in the police force that we're not going to resource this investigation. We'll put our attention elsewhere. We'll resource that case. We'll pursue that case. But those three kids who went missing in that small town, they can have three detectives working on that. I even sat down with the detective who led that investigation at the time, a guy called Alan Williams. And this is decades later. And he's still got boxes and boxes of documents relating to this case in his house. It hasn't left him. And he pulled out a newspaper cutting from the town, from the time of the murders. And it described the killing of another person, a white woman, in a town just north of Bowraville. And the cutting said how the specialist detectives from the homicide squad had been sent up to investigate that killing. And Alan said to me, he said, to get there, those detectives would have driven past the turnoff to Bowraville, three different turnoffs. And on the newspaper cutting, he'd circled it in green and written the words, they never came to Bowraville. So the whole focus of the police force at the highest levels was on other crimes, other killings, and not these three deaths.
What do we know about what happened to those kids?
Well, we know the first one, Colleen, she was 16. She disappeared at a party. And at the time, very little was known. It was almost as if the police were chasing ghosts. But years later, the police reinvestigated it and they found a witness who hadn't come forward and said everything she knew. And she said she'd seen Colleen walking down the side of a house towards the back of the house late at night. And this white man walking down the other side of the same building towards where he'd parked his car. Now, her body's never been found, but her clothes were found in a river, sort of weighed down with stones. And the other two children, Evelyn Greenup, she was 4, and Clinton Speedy Giroux, he was 16. They both disappear at different parties. One of them from a room where she's sleeping, and this same white man is seen walking down the corridor from that room late at night. And then Clinton actually disappears from his caravan, where the two of them went to sleep after a party. Those two, the bodies are found. They're both found dumped beside a road outside Bowraville. And if you follow that road past the first sign where the body's found, past the site where the second body's found, you get to a bridge over a river. And that river just down from the bridge is where Colleen's clothes are found. So not only are the three kids disappear, where they disappear from, the same street on the same town, but where their bodies are found are the same road through the bush above Bowraville. And you look at that, if you stand on that road and you look at where these crimes happened, you think it has to be connected. This must have been one connected series of crimes. But at the time, that's not how the police treated it. They refused to accept a connection. They didn't treat it as a murder investigation. And as a result, you don't know what evidence was missed.
What's the difference? What's the difference between a missing persons investigation and a murder investigation?
Put it like this. One is resources. So a murder investigation, you'd expect there to be far more resources thrown at it very quickly. In those first couple of days, a crime scene would be set up. Forensic evidence would be looked for. You'd be asking key witnesses, what were you doing at a certain time? One of the detectives who worked on this case told me the key difference is with a missing persons investigation, you go around the town, you knock on doors and you say, have you seen this person? Have you seen, say, Colleen? And you might show people a photo of Colleen. But the thing is, memory plays tricks. So if you show people a photo, they might think, yeah, I did see that girl. Mm. I saw her. She was there, or she was there. She was there. Whereas in a murder investigation, you prepare for that eventuality. So you go out and you don't ask people, have you seen this person? You say, what were you doing on this day? What did you see on this day? And then the detectives draw the dots between that evidence. With the missing persons investigation, what they ended up with was lots of people thinking they'd seen these kids alive in different places at different times on different dates. And as a result, they were chasing rumours. They were almost chasing ghosts. And the whole investigation got so confounded by that, so confused, that it started to run into the long grass.
Was there a point at which they said, hang on a second, you know, we've got to start taking this seriously. There's obviously three connected crimes. Let's turn things up a bit.
Absolutely. And what they did was they did charge this one person. Right at the start, they charged him with two of the murders because they only found two of the bodies. But when the cases got to court, and this is where it gets complicated, when the cases got to court, the judge said, you may have been charged with two murders, but we're going to hear them separately in separate trials. Because the law as it stood then, it said it would be prejudicial to the accused to hear evidence about both murders at the same time. So each jury was only told about one murder. Each jury wasn't told that three children had disappeared from the town. They were only told about one of the disappearances. So they never knew that there were similarities and possibly connections between these crimes. They only ever heard part of the evidence. And to this day, even though it's been fought to the highest court in Australia, no jury has ever heard evidence about all three killings at the same time.
Yeah, three children being murdered in the same sort of place and one man being at all three parties is a fact that seems pretty significant to leave out, right?
I mean, maybe he has been found not guilty. I've got to stress, the court's found him not guilty. But each of those juries had only heard part of the evidence. If you speak to the families today, they want people to listen to the facts of what happened. They want people to listen to all of the evidence. They want a court to hear all the evidence at the same time. And without that happening, they question whether, you know, even though this has been to the highest court in the country, they question whether justice can really be said to have been done.
I'm speaking with Dan Box, a former crime reporter for The Australian, who also did a podcast about these murders, and now he has a book on the case simply called Barraville. How did you get involved, by the way, Dan?
Look, it was a strange one. It was about 5 years ago now, and the detective who's leading the investigation now, and he's been working on this for 20-plus years, he asked to meet me. Now, as a crime reporter, that doesn't happen. You don't get asked to meet detectives. You ask to meet them. You're constantly trying to talk to detectives to find out what they know, to get them to tell you things. But this time, he asked to meet me. And we met up outside the police headquarters in Sydney, and he sat me down, and he basically started talking about these three murders. And he told me, these are the crimes, this is what happened. And he said, I think we've got the evidence to put someone away for these murders. But he said, we're not being allowed to. Because this suspect had been found not guilty, at that time it was almost impossible to overturn a not guilty verdict, even if you had new evidence. He was struggling to get it back into court. So he asked to meet me. And I sat there and I thought, well, why does he want to meet me? He's an officer. He's a police officer. I'm a journalist. I guess he wants to use me. He wants to use the newspaper to get attention drawn to this case. And so I had to ask myself if I was doing the right thing by looking at the case, because I was doing what he wanted. And then I thought to myself, look, it's three dead kids. You know, it deserves to be looked at.
And when you first started spending time in Barraville with the Aboriginal elders, was it an uphill battle to gain their trust?
No, they're incredibly decent people. I mean, maybe it took time to gain their trust, but they wanted to be heard. You know, this was 25 years since the murders happened. They wanted people to hear about what happened, and they wanted people to know about it and to act on it. So they made the effort to talk to me, even though I was a stranger, even though I was just a white fella who'd come to town. They made the effort to talk to me because they were determined to be heard. You know, as the years passed and I went back to Bowerville again and again, I learned a lot of lessons about, you know, about respect, to be honest, and about trust and about their acceptance. I remember one conversation I had where I was staying with some friends in the hills above Bowerville, and the woman I was staying with is Aboriginal herself, and I was just about to get up and go to bed. this was when I was pulling the book together, and she said to me, Dan, you've been up here and you've asked your questions of all these people. Have you ever asked them what you can do for them? And I thought to myself, well, no. And my first thought was, look, I'm reporting on this story. Surely that's enough. But actually, it wasn't enough, you know, because I was asking them to tell me hugely emotional things. I was asking them to tell me about the worst thing that could ever happen to a parent. And the guy I was staying with said, don't just be another white reporter who turns up and asks your questions and then leaves and we never hear from you again. And they were right. So what I did after that was I went and I sat with someone from each of the three families and I said, I know I've been here for years. I've been asking my questions. I should have said this before, but what can I do for you? And to their credit, each of the three families just said, keep doing what you're doing. But I needed to ask the question. And I needed to learn that I needed to ask that.
Where are we at legally? Am I correct? There's been two trials and the man in question has been acquitted twice. And
yep.
Any sniff that there might be another go at it?
Well, after we did a podcast on the case, and after that, partly as a result of the podcast, I think, and partly a result of the family's campaigning, the case was sent back to court, the appeal court, and the appeal court was asked to overturn those not guilty verdicts and send this case back to court for all three of the murders together. And it took a couple of years for that to work through. And when they came back, they said no. They said, we're not going to do that. But they didn't say no because they'd looked at the evidence and they thought the evidence was weak. They said no because they looked at the wording of the legislation to do with overturning a not guilty verdict. And that wording, the meaning of certain words within it was uncertain. And if you defined it one way, maybe this evidence could be allowed in. And if you defined it another way, the judges found the evidence, you couldn't look at it. And they defined it in such a way that they actually said, we don't need to look at this evidence. Because of the definition of these words in the legislation, we can discount the evidence completely. So the evidence has still not been heard. And that decision went to the High Court of Australia, and the High Court upheld the appeal court's decision. They said that's the right decision. So now, the chance of this case going back to court is small. People haven't given up. The families haven't given up. The politicians, there are still politicians fighting to change the law again. And there's always the possibility that Colleen's body, which has never been found, that someone, there's a small possibility that that body could have been discovered and there might then be evidence to reopen this case. But I think the chances now are small.
Is this guy still living in Bowraville?
He doesn't live in Bowraville. He's moved out from the town. His family still live there. And that's one of the... When I went to Bowraville, this was the thing that struck me. It's a small town, about 1,000 people, roughly, slightly more. But the families of the murdered children still live in the town. And the family of the man who was found not guilty, but who the police suspected, they still live in the town. And they see each other every day. Some of them still live on the same street. And that's how close and how raw these murders are. So, but he himself doesn't live there. He lives elsewhere, and I've spoken to him. He actually called me up at work when I was involved in reporting on this. And I first spoke to him then, and I've subsequently met him. And he's a living, breathing person. He's a father. He's a grandfather. His neighbours say he's a good dad. And so you look at the evidence, and at first it starts to seem overwhelming. And you think of this guy, and you kind of imagine this suspect, and he's almost an abstract figure in your imagination. And I, at that point, I started to think, well, but surely the police are right. And then you meet him and you learn he's a father and he's a living, breathing, real person. And it becomes a lot harder to believe in his guilt in your own mind. So doing this reporting, I've been working on this for 5 years now. I'm far more uncertain now than I was when I went in, and it's because I think I've met him and I've shaken him by the hand.
Are you certain, or how certain are you of what happened back in 1990?
Look, there's only one person who really knows. I mean, ultimately, I guess it's like any one of these crimes. The only person who really knows what happened is the person who's responsible. The police have spent years working on this, and they've pulled together evidence from dozens and dozens of witnesses, piecing together what happened. But because right at the beginning of this investigation, there were those weeks and months when the police were treating these disappearances as missing persons cases, unconnected missing persons cases, when they weren't setting up crime scenes, when they weren't interviewing witnesses in the first few days after it happened, when their memories were still fresh, you'll never know what evidence was missed. So we don't know what we don't know, if that makes sense. The only person who does is the killer.
Do you have a moment to tell us about the pillow slip?
Yeah, this is the one piece of really, really solid, concrete evidence in the case. So we're talking now about the death of the third child to go missing, a 16-year-old, a teenager, a really bright, popular kid called Clinton. He disappears from the caravan belonging to the man who would later be charged with these murders. So after a party, they both go back to the caravan, they both fall asleep. In the morning, Clinton's missing. Weeks later, they find Clinton's body in the woods next to that road above Bowerville. The detective who was called to the scene immediately told me how he went down and he found what was left of Clinton's body. And he was wearing shorts, and tucked down the front of those shorts, there was a bunch of material. He pulled it out and realized it was a pillow slip. And it had this pattern on it of pink and purple overlapping circles, a little bit like butterflies' wings. And the detective said to me he saw that, and he immediately walked back up the road and got in his car and drove as quickly as he could back to town. And when he got there, he went to that caravan and he walked straight inside because he'd seen that pattern before. And when he got there, there it was. That pattern, those pink and purple overlapping circles, was on the bed sheets in the caravan. And they actually tested them. They sent them for forensic testing, and they discovered a printing flaw in the material. So they didn't just match, but they could tell those blankets in the caravan and the pillow slip were made on the same machine at the same time. They were a matching set. So you had this absolute concrete link between the caravan where Clinton disappeared and Clinton's body, which was found dumped after he was murdered. And that is the most telling piece of evidence in the case. And when the police, if you go back and read the transcripts, when the police first pulled in the guy who lived in that caravan, their suspect, they showed him a photo of the pillow slip and he said, "Do you recognize this?" And he said, "No, I've never seen that before." But of course he had, because they knew that it matched.
And so someone that you spoke to was a police officer who worked on the case. Early on, he told you no one can leave these murders behind once they've been involved. No. Is that true for you, Dan?
Yeah, I think it is true. True for everyone who's been involved. And look, the way, you know, my involvement and the toll it takes is just a shadow of those people who've been much closer, so the police particularly, and particularly the families. I don't even pretend to be able to understand what they felt. You know, no parent should have to bury their child. But the police, pretty much every police officer who's worked on this case has suffered PTSD or a marital breakdown. I've seen one man, a grown man, cry because of this case. And yeah, it affects me. It affected me. It gets on top of you sometimes because you know the families. You've sat down with the mum of a 16-year-old girl who went missing and you've seen the grief rising up in the room. I'm actually going to go up to Bowerville this coming weekend and take up some copies of the book and sit down with each of the three families and show them the book and answer any questions they have. And I think at that point, when I leave having done that, it will start to feel like an end to a process, but at the moment it still feels very much like this is an ongoing thing.
Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the case.
There's so much more, of course, and it's all in the book, which is called Bowerville, Bowraville, and the author is Dan Box.